From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. As we officially enter the holiday season, public health officials are warning of a new crisis in the pandemic. The Centers for Disease Control predicts tens of thousands of new deaths in the weeks before Christmas as people return home from ill-advised Thanksgiving travel. Let's bring in Lena Wen. She's an ER doctor and visiting professor at George Washington University School of Public Health. Dr. Wen, it's nice to have you back, and thank you for making time for us on a holiday weekend.
Of course. Happy to join you.
And what's your prediction for what's ahead after we saw so many people traveling and gathering over this holiday weekend?
We have an impending calamity on our hand because we know that COVID is already everywhere and out of control, and now we're facing a surge upon a surge. We already had surging cases of COVID-19, and we also know that every time people come together over the holidays, we even saw this over Memorial Day, 4th of July, Labor Day, that there was a surge after that. And of course, we have unprecedented numbers of people traveling when we already have a very high baseline level of infection. And all of this, I think, is just so incredibly tragic because we are not that far from the finish line here. We do have vaccines that are on the horizon. And I really hope that everyone will just help us to hang in there for a bit longer because our hospitals are already getting overwhelmed. We're already to the point that we could see our healthcare systems collapsing. And we really need to hang in there and get through this very, very challenging winter.
The CDC is projecting that by December 19th, the number of Americans dead from COVID-19 will total more than 320,000. That's before Christmas. With this surge upon surge, as you say, do you think the death toll is about to jump dramatically?
Yes. I hate to say this, but this is what happens because death is a lagging indicator, meaning that first we're going to see an increased level of infections. Then we're going to see increased hospitalizations even more than we currently have, then ICUs getting even more overwhelmed. And then after that, deaths will spike. And not only deaths from COVID-19, but when hospitals become so full that physicians and nurses are unable to provide optimal care, then we also have other patients coming in with heart attacks, with strokes, for cancer care, for car accidents, who are not able to get ideal care as well. And we're going to see mortality increase from these other causes as well. Now, I just hope that people will keep in mind, none of this at this point is inevitable. There are things that are in our power. I know ultimately this is failure of our federal policy, and the administration should have done a much better job. But there are things that we as individuals can do, and that includes continuing to wear masks, continuing to avoid indoor gatherings, and really doing our best through this challenging period. Again, it's not for forever, but we have to get through this winter.
Well, in fact, there is one projection out from the University of Washington that says we could save 40,000 lives over the next 2 months if 95% of people wore masks. And yet, you know, we're still seeing cases. For example, this week, Governor Mark Gordon of Wyoming tested positive for the coronavirus after months of resisting a statewide mask mandate. What's not clicking for people here?
I mean, I think for us in public health, it's really challenging to see this when something that is a basic public health measure is being politicized and is in fact held up as a partisan symbol, a cultural touchpoint for many people. And we need to enlist credible messengers, in many cases, prominent Republican leaders, business leaders, pastors, religious leaders. We know in public health that the messenger is often even more important than the message. And so the more people can help us out with that message is absolutely essential.
Okay, on the issue of vaccines, there is some big questions today about the way that drug maker AstraZeneca conducted its vaccine trial and the way that it dosed some of its participants. Can you explain what's going on here?
Yeah, so it appears that AstraZeneca, in reporting their initial, what sounded like very positive results, actually left out some really important components, including how they came across this even more effective regimen. The regimen that they had initially established looked like it was about 63% effective. But then it seems like they accidentally gave some people a half dose of the vaccine. The first dose was a half dose as opposed to the full dose. And they got a 90% effectiveness, which is great. And maybe one of those things that ends up resulting in an accidental great discovery. But that still should have been disclosed. And, you know, it is, first of all, the best practice, but also there's so much scrutiny on vaccines right now. The last thing that we need is for more people to have distrust in the process. And transparency is the best antidote to that fear. And also, just to let everyone know, too, so far the irregularities are with AstraZeneca. There are no concerns with the Pfizer, the Moderna trials that are underway. And I hope that this one incident is isolated and does not then somehow make people doubt the credibility of all the vaccine trials that are underway, because there's so much good news that's coming out from these vaccines. And I am certain that the FDA will not be taking any shortcuts when evaluating these vaccine candidates for approval.
But the world needs as many options as it can get in terms of distributing and creating these vaccines. So what does it mean for AstraZeneca's injection? Could it be out of the running altogether?
No, at the moment, it does not appear so. But I hope, again, that they will be much more transparent with their reporting. And you're absolutely right that we need as many possible candidates as we can, because we are talking about vaccinating not only hundreds of millions of Americans, but the entire world, in order for us to have any chance of eradicating COVID-19.
Lina Nguyen, ER doctor and visiting professor at George Washington University's School of Public Health. Thanks, as always, for your insight. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Do you remember Brexit? The United Kingdom did technically leave the European Union, but that wasn't really the end of the story. BBC political correspondent Rob Watson has been our guide through the thicket of Brexit, which now continues. There's a key deadline to reach a trade deal coming up in just a few weeks. Rob is on Skype from the UK. Rob, welcome back. It's been a while.
Well, it's good to be with you, and I can assure you the thicket is as thick as ever. But I guess what maybe is changing is that the deadline is getting ever, ever closer for Britain to leave the European Union.
Yeah, catch us up, would you? Because we Americans have been, as you can imagine, distracted with some other things the last couple of months. There has been this transition period because the UK left the EU on January 31st, and then the rest of the year was supposed to be spent working on this trade deal. Where do things stand?
You guys distracted? Surely not. Well, I got to say, it's been sort of the same here. You're right. So what the last few months were supposed to be about was saying, okay, Britain has left the European Union. What's the future relationship between the UK and the EU going to be? Primarily that's about trade, but other things as well, security. And so far, even though we are, I'm not quite sure how many days we are away from the 31st of December, that agreement has not been reached.
There's also a new wrinkle here, isn't there? And it's related to the United States. President-elect Joe Biden was on the phone with Prime Minister Boris Johnson this week and the leader of Ireland, and made it clear that he's opposed to a guarded border between Northern Ireland and Ireland. So catch us up on that issue, and what kind of wrinkle a new incoming U.S. president could throw into the situation.
Oh, I think it's much more than a wrinkle. I think you're being very diplomatic and polite and kind about it. I mean, as seen from London, I think the election of Joe Biden is really complicates things, at least as far as Brexit is concerned, because there is now an incoming U.S. administration who, like the rest of Britain's allies, thinks that Brexit is truly crazy. I mean, let's not beat about the bush. You have a U.S. that's now returning to what has been the status quo position of U.S. foreign policy the last 40 years, which it wanted a strong and united Europe, with Britain a big part of that, as in part to sort of help the United States make its case in Europe. So we've gone back to that, and that is not helpful for Mr. Johnson and the UK government. So you have that. You also have building economic pressures. Indeed, only this week, an independent forecaster that the government uses warned that all versions of Brexit would be even more damaging to the economy than the pandemic.
Yeah, speaking of this pandemic, the national lockdown that Boris Johnson has imposed is ending next week, but I know some people are still upset about the fact that bars and pubs are gonna be closed. What's the feeling there in England as the end of the year approaches? You got Brexit potentially happening here, but you've also got this awful virus.
I could sum it up in one word: grim. There is this potential of a perfect storm, and we know it was leaked out this week, the government had done a sort of absolute worst case modeling scenario. And it was truly apocalyptic because the scenario included the pandemic, the second spike continuing and nobody allowed into the pubs, the potential of flooding that we get at this time of year. And of course, Brexit, the idea that there would be shortages of food and shortages of all sorts of other potential supplies. So the mood is undoubtedly grim. I mean, as in the United States, as indeed in other countries, people have been really ground down with the lockdown. Just one thing that's worth pointing out, the modelling done by the government's own independent advisor on sort of budgetary matters suggested that if there was going to be a no-deal Brexit, that would delay the recovery from the pandemic by at least a year and leave Britain permanently 2% poorer.
Wow. BBC political correspondent Rob Watson, it's good to hear from you again.
Good to hear from you, Peter. I'm sorry if I have to keep using the word grim, but there you are.
If you're a fan of country music, you'll probably recognize this voice. Grammy-winning country star Clint Black released a new album in June. It had been a while. Out of Sane is his 23rd studio album and his first in 5 years. That's What I Knew Then, written with longtime collaborator Hayden Nichols. I spoke with Clint Black about Out of Sane back in June. So here you are releasing your 23rd studio album in the middle of a pandemic. That's got to be kind of a different situation.
Yeah, well, everything started off normal enough, and it took a turn. And it's been weird, but not that weird for me, because when I come home off the road, I tend to stay home most of the time. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that weird for a while, and then it started to become weird.
Well, let's talk about some of the music, because, you know, we are in a moment in this country right now, and I think you know that. When I hear this track, it is called America, Still in Love with You.
We had a rocky start, never certain it would last. We nearly came apart, but now that's all in the past. We stood the test of time, and though it doesn't seem that long, we've towed the line for years now, and we're still going strong. You've gotta know you're not alone. I'm still in love.
Clint Black, tell me about this song, because you sound optimistic about this country at a time when, you know, frankly, many are despairing over the future of it.
Yeah, I am optimistic. I'm a history buff, so I know a bit about what America has been through. So when people say this is the worst it's ever been, I know that's not true. America's aspirations are great. Its future is always uncertain. We can't know what's going to happen next. But if history tells us anything, we will get through this and we will be more united than ever before.
There may be people who listen to this who also draw on history who say, you know what, this doesn't apply to me. In fact, America is not my friend, like you say in the song, that its deep structural problems through history have kept me down.
Well, I would just remind them that there are a lot of people who fought, some died, to see the change come about. And that should give them hope. I think if you look around for the tiles that didn't stick to the wall, then that's all you're going to know. But if you focus on the ones that stayed, it might give you hope.
I'm still in love with you, even when you lose your way. There's nothing I won't do to bring you better days.
You're the best one that I've got, and I'm still in love. we're going to talk more about your music in just a minute, but I just have to ask you this final question, because I know that you know Donald Trump. You were a contestant on Celebrity Apprentice back in 2009. I mean, what do you think? Has the president been good for this country?
You know, I don't really know him. It's kind of like doing the Tonight Show when you're on camera and the show is running. That's the interaction.
But he fired you. You know that for sure.
He did fire me. I was grateful, and I was headed home, and they begged me to come back for the finale as a returning cast member, and I regretted that instantly. It's such an abusive environment. As far as Donald Trump goes, as the president, I think if you hate him, you're not going to find anything good, and if you love him, maybe you're not going to find anything bad. You know, I just go with the idea that I have my vote. I'm very private about it. I tend to get upset about government spending, and I haven't seen anyone do a lot about that. And that should be a bipartisan issue. I don't know anyone who squanders their own wealth away with disregard, and we shouldn't stand by and watch our government do it.
Well, listen, thank you for talking politics with me. I know you're here to promote a new album, so let's hear some more of it. This is Everybody's Talking.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear a word they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind.
Now, people might remember this song from the 1960s by Fred Neil, featured in the film Midnight Cowboy. Isn't this pretty rare for you to cover something that's not yours? You know, of all the songs you could have picked, why this one?
I kind of was inspired to do that by James Taylor, who I noticed for at least a few albums he would include one cover song. And I think it speaks to my influences and hopefully an ability to breathe new life into something that we've all loved for years without ruining it in the process.
Yeah. You know, I love looking back with artists. And so I would you mind if we just, like, listen to something from the 80s and 90s? Because you were huge in the 90s, and I just want to hear a little bit of that, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Okay, this is Where Are You Now?
Maybe I took for granted you'd be around to pick me up on my way down. I thought my feet were planted firmly on the ground till one day my whole world came unwound.
You remember that one, Clint Black?
Oh, yeah. That's one of the rare songs I wrote on the road. My lead guitar player and I wrote it in the back of the bus. His mom was in trouble, health troubles, and she was the person he had relied on his whole life, and now that person wasn't there to help him get through this, sort through it. And that was his burning question, you know, where is that person who's going to help me figure this out?
I remember my dad, just not a very emotional guy at all, just belting the chorus of that song out every time it came on. I grew up listening to you in the 80s and 90s, and I always will remember that song.
That's a burning question on fire in my mind. You always had the answers for me time after time. So all I'm asking is where are. Where are you now?
What's your impression of the 90s? Was it a fun time, a hard time, or what?
It was all of that. It was a whirlwind. It was, you know, it was a time when I was working so hard that my chief concern was, am I going to be able to sing tonight? You know, I remember telling my manager, you know, I'm not Joe Cocker, and I don't want to sound like Joe Cocker. You know, we have to remember the kinds of songs I sing, the sounds and the high notes I have to hit, and we've got a safeguard. It didn't happen, so eventually I kind of fought back against that. And, yeah, I used to tell people, you know, what drives all of my decisions now is, am I going to be able to hit the high note on Put Yourself in My Shoes?
Mm-hmm.
And it became a fight, almost a desperate fight at times, to push back against the pressure to just keep talking.
And if I could only put myself in your shoes, I'd walk right back to me. I'd walk right back to me. I'd walk right back to me.
That was a good song. I love that song.
Thanks.
Yeah, listen, let's hear one more from the new album. Here's Find Myself.
Have my life's been suitcase packed? Some kind of gig back on my back. Seems like one long endless tour.
I hear some of the high notes there a little bit.
Yeah, that's it. You don't roll out of bed and sing that one.
Look, I consulted this source called Wikipedia who tells me you're 58 years old.
Yeah.
How much longer are you going to be making albums? Do you think you have, like, Willie Nelson longevity in you?
Well, God only knows, right? You know, it's all about health, and I still have the desire. I look to people like Willie Nelson, like Eric Clapton, Paul McCartney, and they give me hope. If James Taylor, you know, can still be making some of his best music at his age, maybe I can too.
Clint Black's album Out of Sane is out now. We spoke last June. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now and the following message is brought to you by the New England Innovation Academy, an innovative engine for students in grades 6 through 12, the first middle and high school that prepares innovators to shape the world through human-centered design. Part world school, part incubator, teaching the cultural dexterity and global focus this era demands. To learn more, visit neiacademy.org.
We're following some breaking news today from the Middle East. The man who once led Iran's nuclear program has been killed in an attack just outside the capital, Tehran. Iranian state media has blamed the attack on armed terrorist elements. NPR's Peter Kenyon is in Istanbul. He's been following this story. And Peter, first of all, tell us more about this man. Who is he and what happened to him?
Well, his name is Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. He was an important figure in Iran's nuclear program. He was once described as the man who'd be known as the father of the Iranian bomb if Tehran ever succeeded in creating a nuclear weapon. Israel has called him the head of Iran's nuclear weapons efforts. This shooting attack was not the first time he's been targeted. Several other Iranian nuclear scientists have as well. Four were killed between 2010 and 2012 in a series of shooting or bomb attacks back then, blamed on Israel, which they refused to confirm or deny. And this is, of course, early stages on this killing. New details could come out.
All right. And we know Iran's enemy, Israel, as you've already mentioned, has struck Iranian targets in the past. Have they said anything about this one today?
No. The Iranian officials are definitely calling it an assassination, deliberate shooting attack. State media have shown images of a bullet-riddled vehicle. Their number one suspect, Iran, is Israel, as we've said. One military advisor to the supreme leader says, quote, in the last days of the political life of their ally, meaning President Trump, the Zionists, meaning Israel, seek to intensify pressure on Iran and create a full-blown war. So that's certainly how the Iranians are viewing it.
Well, in fact, President Trump has raised the possibility of an attack on Iran recently with military and other senior officials, but the reporting is that some of them pushed back on the idea, fearing that U.S. troops in the region would be retaliated against. Is there a concern that this most recent outbreak of violence could create a more dangerous situation for American troops in the Middle East?
Well, that is definitely a concern. They're concerned, especially in Iraq, where they have been hit by Iran-backed militias in the past. And, of course, the timing of this attack is interesting in more than one way, on more than one level. I mean, the Trump administration has been very clear. It wants to keep maximum pressure on Iran during its final weeks in power. Some have even suggested the administration would like to leave U.S.-Iran relations so tense when the Biden administration takes office that it becomes very difficult, if not impossible, for any kind of immediate re-engagement, such as the question of whether Biden would try to rejoin the 2015 nuclear agreement with Iran. Trump pulled out of that in 2018. Will Biden try to lift sanctions that were imposed by Trump if the situation is this tense? I mean, that's an interesting question.
It sounds like you're saying, regardless of the facts here, this assassination could further destabilize the Middle East.
Well, obviously, there's a big potential for destabilization now. It's increased. A lot will happen. A lot will depend, I should say, on what happens next in terms of reprisals or even further attacks. There's still several more weeks to go in the Trump administration, and the Iranians have certainly shown a propensity to respond tit for tat in some form or other when they've been attacked in the past.
And we are still in the early hours of this conflict, and we'll watch it as it develops. NPR's Peter Kenyon is reporting from Istanbul. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Peter.
Germany is the latest European country to surpass 1 million confirmed cases of COVID-19. The country's disease control center says Germany's 16 states reported more than 22,000 cases in the last 24 hours, and that pushed the total past 1 million. NPR's Rob Schmitz joins us now from Berlin. Rob, welcome.
Thanks, Peter.
And right now, Germany is about a month into what the government calls a wave breaker shutdown, but you've also just passed 1 million cases there. How are things going?
Well, obviously not that great. Schools and most shops have remained open in this latest lockdown, but, you know, we're seeing bars, gyms, other indoor leisure centers have been closed. Restaurants are only open for takeaway orders. This week, Chancellor Angela Merkel announced that the country will have to live with these restrictions through December 20th. At the earliest. And so far, the lockdown does seem to be accomplishing what it set out to accomplish, which is to stem the exponential growth of cases. And authorities believe it's helped Germans reduce their social contact by around 40%. And that, in turn, has prevented this growth in infections. And I should point out here, though, that the daily numbers of confirmed cases have remained pretty high for Germany. We're looking at around 20,000 or more cases per day at the moment, and hospitals remain pretty busy.
One of the interesting things about Germany throughout the course of this pandemic is that its death rate has been quite a bit lower, if not the lowest, of all European countries. What's the explanation for that?
Yeah, there are two main reasons for that. First, the latest wave of infections has, for the most part, impacted younger and healthier people. So, you know, they get sick, but we've seen fewer deaths. Secondly, Germany's healthcare infrastructure is among the best in the world. And even though hospitals are very busy, ICU beds are still available.
Christmas is coming, and I know that is a very big holiday in Germany with all those big festive Christmas markets there. What's the plan for Christmas? You know, just like the conversation we were having here in the United States about people gathering for Thanksgiving, how are people preparing for the upcoming holiday there?
Yeah, anyone who's been to Germany knows that Christmas is obviously a very special time of year here. You've got these famous Christmas markets everywhere, and they are a victim of these restrictions as well. Many of the biggest ones aren't going to be happening, and the ones that will go on will be limited to these small neighborhood Glühwein stands where you can just get a warm cup of Glühwein. Christmas tree farms are open, but as I've learned firsthand, we have to reserve a time slot to cut down our tree, so I'm doing that this Sunday. The lockdown extension that was just passed will be eased somewhat during Christmas week so that the number of people allowed to gather will rise from 5 to 10. But the government is asking for people to avoid all social contact the week before visiting their families for Christmas.
NPR's Rob Schmitz in Berlin. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In at least four U.S. cities this week, someone toppled or sprayed graffiti on monuments in buildings with the words "Land Back." Land Back is a campaign for indigenous sovereignty. The vandalism occurred on the week of Thanksgiving, which many Native Americans have described as a national day of mourning. Along the southern shore of Long Island, the Shinnecock Nation is trying to protect its sovereign land, located in the town of Southampton. The Shinnecock are surrounded by wealth, but 60% of its population lives below the poverty line. For weeks, members of the tribe camped out in the cold, protesting along the only road into the Hamptons. The demonstration ended yesterday, and a lawyer representing the Shinnecock Nation, Tila Troge, joins us now. Tila, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
So your protest is over. Probably a tough month. I mean, it's the month of November. It's not exactly warm outside. What was it like out there for the last couple of weeks?
It was an extreme experience. We were under a tornado watch one day. We had bad storms that tore apart the camp some nights. But at the same time, it really was a beautiful experience because we had so many supporters come to visit the camp, and we were able to build really strong alliances that will help us in the long term.
So this demonstration was, on the surface at least, about an electronic billboard that state and local governments didn't want up on the side of the road. But what was it that was driving members of this community to camp outside for several weeks?
The Shinnecock Nation has been involved in litigation over its most recent economic development project, which is a 61-foot monument towering over ancestral homelands in Westwoods, Hampton Bays, New York. And there's just been a great amount of controversy over the monuments themselves. And so things really pushed a tipping point with the COVID-19 pandemic. Things started to get really bad for the Shinnecock Nation and for the surrounding area. There's been a lot of food insecurity and just economic fallout from the pandemic.
You call it a monument. It's an interesting word to use. It's also an electronic billboard. So why is it so important to you that you would have such a state of reference for it?
A lot of people aren't even aware that there is a Native tribe living in the Hamptons. The education system in this country has completely failed to educate people about not only the history of Native people, but the continued existence of Native people. So the monument was so important to the Shinnecock Nation because it's located right at the entry to the Hamptons, and it's 61 feet tall. It's an absolutely beautiful sign. It's lit up. You certainly can't miss it, and it's just really a testament to the Shinnecock Nation's continued existence and the fact that once you drive past the sign, you're entering Shinnecock territory.
And is part of the importance that it allows you to raise revenue for the tribe?
Yes. Again, revenue is desperately needed. So this litigation brought by New York is most certainly not the first attempt to destroy Shinnecock's engagement in economic development.
So we reached out to the town supervisor of Southampton, Jay Schneiderman, and he declined to speak to us about this. But he did tell the New York Times the sign was clearly out of character for the community. How do you interpret something like that?
I mean, it's offensive. All of their overdevelopment of our homelands is really what's out of character, you know, and especially, again, not to harp on this, but with COVID-19, we saw a mass exodus of people from Manhattan out into the Hamptons in homes that they previously used as second homes, but now they're kind of permanently there, and we just don't have the infrastructure to support them. The entire town of Southampton is not connected to any type of wastewater treatment, and all of their water runoff contains nitrogen from their septic systems, which is just totally killing all of our marine life, and it's just having a devastating, detrimental effect on the environment. And, you know, for the most part, our land here is completely vacant, except for this monument, which has an extraordinarily small footprint.
Well, as these types of stories often do, this one goes way back. The Shinnecock had an agreement going back to 1703 when Southampton signed a 1,000-year lease with the tribe for 3,500 acres. And it looks like you have control of it, like what, something like 800 acres today? Is that right?
Right, exactly. So we actually have two territories, and one of them where our current encampment, Sovereignty Camp 2020, is at is about 80 acres, and it's bisected by Sunrise Highway, which was placed here illegally by the state of New York in 1959. And then our other territory is about 800 acres, and that's where most Shinnecock people live today.
Mm. So that's why the wound runs deep. I mean, you're an impoverished tribe living in one of the wealthiest places in the country. What are you asking for? What would help the tribe heal and move forward? Is it just about this sign being able to stand?
I mean, I always tell everyone it's not about this sign. None of this is about the sign. I think that in order to really start healing, we need to have the town and just the wider population really begin a process of truth and reconciliation. There's a lot of misinformation out there. And one of the beautiful things about Sovereignty Camp is that when people stop by and really got to hear our history and really start questioning things, I mean, it really leaves you with no opportunity but to side with us.
New York is a pretty liberal place, as I know you're aware. Do you sometimes get the sense that people are sort of willing to say they're supportive of issues like tribal sovereignty, but then if it's right in front of them and affects their own lives, they might be not so brave in standing up to it?
I think that's absolutely spot on. But again, we do ask for people to reach out to us. We're extremely approachable, and you know, you can't help but to become engaged with our struggle.
That's Tila Troge, a lawyer for the Shinnecock Nation on Long Island in New York. Tila, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Many Thanksgiving dinners were smaller this year, but you still might find yourself today looking for ways to reassemble your leftovers. Our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, is here to help. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you, Peter.
And you and I have talked before about what to do with Thanksgiving leftovers. Of course, the difference this time is that we're not face-to-face. We're far apart. Tell me how this has been a different Thanksgiving season for you.
Well, in so many ways, the whole year has been not quite normal, as everybody knows. Hopefully, we were at smaller, safer tables with smaller gatherings, and therefore, the leftover landscape, what you find in your refrigerator today, might be different than it was a few years ago when it might have been overflowing with half a bird and all kinds of vegetables and potatoes. But there are still so many possibilities of what to do with whatever it is you have left over.
Mm-hmm. So keeping that in mind, that people may have had smaller gatherings this year, not as much food left in the refrigerator, walk us through what your thoughts are. Because I know you've said in the past that when we talk about leftovers, we kind of have the wrong mindset, that it's old food and that really what we should be doing is thinking of new possibilities altogether.
Exactly. It is a mindset. Many people think leftovers is kind of a dirty word. I see it as food that's already cooked, that is now ready for its next chapter. It's got a whole new set of possibilities and all the time saving. So whether you roasted a chicken or half of a turkey or just a thigh or only a few mashed potatoes, we can still work magic with that.
No doubt. Now, you also have a new recipe to share this year, one that might come as a relief if you've been eating too much this Thanksgiving.
Yeah, and that's probably true for a whole lot of us. I wanted something light and bright and seasonal. So I took some greens, in this case, arugula and baby spinach. You could use kale, your favorite type of lettuce. I sliced some of my leftover turkey, placed that in the middle of the plate, and then I cut away the rind and the pith, that's the white part, of a beautiful juicy orange, made thin slices, put these beautiful juicy orange slices around the turkey and greens, and then I made quick pickled red onions, which I will go into in a minute, much faster and quicker than you think. And then I took my leftover cranberry sauce and made a vinaigrette out of it. So this salad had the leftover cranberries. I had half an onion that I had peeled. It had my turkey. It had a brand new beautiful orange. And then the greens left over from last night's salad. And it is really a beautifully refreshing salad.
Sounds amazing. Tell me about these pickled red onions.
Okay, so here's the deal. You slice a red onion very thinly. You put it in a mason jar or a plastic container. Put some cider vinegar on top of it, a little bit of kosher or canning salt, a tablespoon of sugar, grinding a black pepper, and an hour later, you have pickles. And they keep in the fridge for about a week. And the thing about these pickled red onions is that they're acidic and they're bright also, but they add this kind of piquancy from the onion that just brightens up all kinds of leftovers. I put it on sandwiches. I put it on salads. I put it on top of a soup or a stew. It's a bright crunch, and it's also a beautiful color.
So tell me what else you're doing. I know that you're a fan of taking a traditionally American meal and spicing it up with some international flavors the day after. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, there are so many possibilities. And whether you've roasted a chicken or a turkey, you could do a quick ramen, the Japanese noodle soup. There's a wonderful Chinese stir fry with tofu, and I chop up any extra turkey to make a mapo tofu, a very spicy, fiery tofu dish. Mm-hmm. You could do a peanut butter and sesame spicy paste and cut leftover chicken or turkey and put it on skewers, put it under the broiler for a minute and serve it with that spicy sauce. A completely new flavor profile from any traditional Thanksgiving, where, again, the turkey or the leftover has a whole new possibility. Tacos, smash leftover sweet potato or squash onto a corn tortilla. You don't even need to add any meat or poultry. Add those pickled red onions, add some chopped tomatoes, enchiladas. I could go on and on and on. The point is to think outside the box and get creative.
Yeah, but Kathy, don't be mad at me if I just put the turkey and the mashed potatoes and the gravy on a plate and microwave it. No, I'm not gonna do that, I promise.
You know, the one thing I'll say is that this has been a very difficult and unusual year. And, you know, the way that we've shopped has changed so much this year. Many of us are not going into grocery stores. A lot of people gardened and grew their own food this year, and they're going to farmers markets and finding safe ways to buy locally produced food. So you want to use that food and stretch it as much as you can. And that's why thinking of leftovers as brand new possibilities is so important this year.
I hear you, and thank you so much for those great ideas. Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst will have all these recipes at hereandnow.org. They sound amazing. Kathy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd, wishing you a safe and happy holiday weekend. It's Here and Now.